This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. Today's host is Kelly McLean.
Jeremy Cohen is the communications director and head writer for Talk Death. He is a full-time PhD candidate in religious studies at McMaster University, where he studies the intersections of death and technology. Mandy is the editor of Talk Death and co-host of the hashtag Talk Death web series. She is also the founder and CEO of the online memorial platform Keeper, Q-E-E-P-R, which you can find at QEEPR.com. Mandy works part-time as a funeral director's assistant and regularly attends and speaks at funeral and cemetery conferences. Talk Death's mission is to encourage positive and constructive conversations around death and dying. Awareness of issues and needs surrounding death is growing, as we know, and it's still not quite considered appropriate dinner table talk. But at talkdeath.com, they feel it is. They've created an amazing online space where you can safely talk about any issues related to death and dying and grief and death art and all that good stuff, really not unlike our own site. Jeremy and Mandy kindly joined me today to share their experience at the Death Salon, which, for those of you who don't know, is the premier death positive gathering in the world and the coolest death conference, I think. Last year, it really set the stage for a lot of what we ended up talking about and a lot of the content we ended up producing in 2018. And since we weren't able to make it this year, I asked Jeremy and Mandy to join me and tell me all about it. So Jeremy Cohen and Mandy Ben-Waleed, thank you both so much for joining us on the When You Die podcast. We were really sad to not get to be there in person this year. Last year, I felt like it kind of set the stage for a lot of the research and exploration and articles that we've done. And I just thought it would be great to reach out to people who were actually there to give us a hit of what we missed. And I know that we're not alone in feeling like a lot of curiosity about what happened at the Death Salon.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty exclusive event, right? There was only, I think, about 150 tickets available. So we are lucky to attend, and we're happy to be talking to you about it.
Yeah, you're some of the early birds that got the worm. So
actually, we were lucky and managed to snag tickets off people who canceled last minute. So we actually booked ourselves like a week in advance.
But you scalped tickets.
We did.
Awesome. We did. So was this your first time to a Death Salon?
No, we had gone to the Death Salon at the Muter Museum in Philadelphia 2 years ago.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, which was nice. We got an interesting comparative experience, I'd say.
Right. What did you notice that was different this year from that experience?
I think for starters, it felt a lot more intimate. And a lot of that is really because of how small Mount Auburn is. Well, actually, sorry, Mount Auburn's massive, but the main building and where all the presentations were happening was a very small and intimate space, which is, of course, why they had to limit the tickets so much.
Yeah, I remember when we walked into the chapel, I was thinking like, oh, okay, this chapel is like a really great, you know, place to start the weekend. I wonder where all the talks are going to be.
Yeah.
And then it was in the chapel.
Yeah, that's it. I was really surprised too. I was like, oh, wow, it really is this small.
Yeah.
That's kind of a perfect setting though for a Death Salon, and that's kind of how I would imagine it happening in the 1800s Death Salons that we talk about, is that kind of space.
Exactly. And I think it I really enjoyed that intimacy. And you know, to bring it back to Philadelphia, even though I don't know if Philly had that many more people, maybe had an extra 100 people. But even just the space was a lot larger. The room was a lot larger, you know, even just the high ceilings. And, you know, the presentations felt more like you were, let's say, like in a university setting, whereas this was more of a salon setting, as you mentioned.
You know, the other difference was that this death salon was really focused on death as a political act and on reclaiming death, whereas the original death salon was also focused on those things, but there were a lot of talks about art and a lot of talks mm-hmm. about different, you know, different cultural.
Yeah, there was like a lot more academic talks, I think, on that one. And yeah, that's actually a funny point that you mentioned, because I do feel like, you know, just from our personal experience, the first time around, we were almost like nervous and really shy and like not really, like we knew some people there, but very few people. Whereas coming to this one, we just felt like we already like knew so many people there, and like people came up to us because they recognized us from the internet, which like never happens like
mm-hmm.
at all.
Right.
So you guys are death famous is what you're saying?
Yeah. We're minor celebrities in a very small group of people. It feels great.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, it felt a little different for us in that way for sure.
Can you say more about, I really liked, Jeremy, when you said that death was, one of the focuses was death as a political act. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was a reminder that death is always political. And some of the ways that we were reminded of that at the death salon were obvious. Other ways were perhaps a little less obvious. You know, one of the issues, and, you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this more in a bit, but was race. And that's something that I feel like is often missing in discussions around death positivity. And there were quite a few talks that dealt with race in both traditional death practices and the place of race within the death positive movement. And, you know, it also dealt, I think there were a lot of talks that also dealt with historical exclusion and the ways in which these meta narratives have been built around death and dying. And it was pretty powerful.
And I think even on a more, you know, if we're talking about, you know, if we're talking about politics sort of more generally, even just the laws, the rules and regulations around death practices, around our funerary and burial rights, was brought up a lot. And it was political, again, in the sense that a huge theme that, again, we'll probably touch on more is community movement and how it has to be, you know, a grassroots movement and how people need to act and take action, essentially, which obviously in and of itself is a very, you know, political action and message.
Yeah, there was almost a call to action.
Definitely was.
Yeah, in a lot of the talks that I feel like was missing from, well, not missing, but was less present, let's say, at the Death Salon 2 years ago.
I felt that a little bit last year as well. Just this sense that there's an exigent need for a death revolution. Like, come on already, the way that we relate to life in this society has evolved a lot since the industrial age, and the way we relate to death since that time actually hasn't changed all that much. So yeah. This kind of like desire to modernize death and to allow it to be a beautiful thing rather than just, you know, whatever awkward arrangement we all just go along with at this time.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think it's actually interesting that you were at Seattle and we weren't at Seattle, but we were at the one before then, Philadelphia.
Right. So between the three of us, we can piece together.
Yeah, there's definitely been an evolution. Exactly.
Yeah. So can you guys say more about the ways in which, I guess, like what were some of the presentations that support this?
Well, so I think it really starts, I think one of the main themes I think one of the main themes and something that was really predominant in this death salon And I feel like in all death salons, mostly because of what the death positive movement really looks like now, i.e. women working in death care, right? And this really started with the feminist death work panel that was moderated by Sarah Chavez and involved Dr. Cami Fletcher and Elua Arthur. And they talked about women in death care maybe a little differently than what other narratives you're hearing today. So, you know, their conversations were about women, you know, there's mostly women in this room and mostly women in these alternative death care practices and movements, because it's about women reclaiming, you know, our bodies and reclaiming our role in caring for the dead. Because as many know, you would die at home, and often it was the women's role, so to speak, to care for the dead, to wash the body, to dress the body. And, you know, it's reclaiming that role sort of against the, you know, the professionalization, which really did push women out of that work and turn them into consumers, right? So that was a big part of it, which of course that in and of itself is also very political.
And I think that it was an important conversation to have, because I feel like when I have brought up the gender demographic of the death positive movement...
Because you always feel like you're the only guy there.
Yes, that is true. But I often...
Great for single dudes though, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Single dudes that have a thing for goth girls, it's probably hot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're just going to pick up, you know? But, you know, I think that the answer that I often hear is that, oh, well, women are just more caring, and women, you know, have
a sort of motherly or nurturing qualities.
Exactly. And this is giving a more concrete answer to why women are so predominant in the death positive movement and why they are so concerned with the care of the dead. And I think Elua said during her talk, I'm quoting her here, that the system is broken and women are at the center of fixing it because it is ours and will continue to be ours. And I thought that was a really powerful statement.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing too, in terms of politics and general themes, you know, there was mostly women in the room. But it was also a lot of white women in the room, right?
Yes, it was definitely mostly white women in the room. And, you know, following from this women in death care theme, there is definitely a huge underlying race issue. And that definitely came out within that panel with Elua and with Dr. Fletcher.
Yeah. And I think this was also explored in Cami Fletcher's talk about the African-American experience in death care. And she was giving a talk about the first autonomously Black cemetery in America, which was aptly named Mount Auburn, but in Baltimore. And before this cemetery was established, African-Americans tended to be buried in paupers' graves and in potters' fields, and oftentimes their bodies would be taken for medical examination. And so this was an opportunity for Black people to care for the dead on their own. And the interesting thing about it is that it allowed Black people in America to participate as consumers and as professionals. And these were two things that were denied to them before that. And so with Mount Auburn Cemetery in Baltimore, you also saw the rise in Black undertakers and Black coffin makers, Black headstone makers, and all these industries that come along with death and dying. And I think that, you know, the problem with a lot of the discussion in the death positive movement, you know, when you ignore things like race, when you homogenize feminism, is that you often end up denying people their history, their struggles, and, you know, a lot of important contemporary practices. It kind of creates these meta narratives, and that's a problem.
Yeah, we like it basically whitewashes funeral practices when death is a really big deal in African American cultures. You know, just take, you know, the obvious example would be in New Orleans, of course, where we have, you know, these parades and how it's such a strong piece of their culture. And, you know, everywhere else, it seems like we try, like, as we keep mentioning the word, homogenizing it. And honestly, I feel like we kind of whitewash it.
Well, I know even in my own work, and I will read old papers that I've written, you know, old articles that have been published, and I kind of shake my head now because the way I wrote about death was also kind of whitewashed everything, where I was like, oh, well, you know, in the 19th century, everyone did X and everyone did Y, and then professionals came along and then that stopped happening. And I realized, well, this is only one person or one group's experience. It's not necessarily the experience of all groups in America and North America. And I think that Cami Fletcher and Alua Arthur's presentations and the discussion that happened around their talks was a really important reminder of that.
Yeah, I mean, so I feel like even this, what we just spoke about, definitely leads us to another one of the larger themes, which is about communities reclaiming death care. And it's interesting when you mention that other death salons were more focused on, you know, the individuals and maybe more on the ideology and less about movement and action and actually, you know, what happens when you die. And there was the Natural Death Care Collaborative panel with folks from the Fetal Consumers Alliance, the National Home Funeral Alliance, people from different green burial type of associations. And what they really talked about was actually in the title is unconsuming death and reclaiming funerals from commercialized culture. And a lot of it was, you know, as we mentioned, about reclaiming death care and the rituals around it. And I think someone that definitely resonated with a lot of people would be Nora Bah from the Janaza Project. And he essentially works in New York and New Jersey with the Muslim community. And, you know, he first kind of got the crowd by talking about how Muslim burial is the OG, which he specifically mentioned is the original gangster of green burial. And that's very true. So that was really interesting. And he talked about how, you know, traditional Muslim burial, actually very similar to Jewish burials as well, you know, do not embalm. They bury the body as early as possible, either just in a shroud or in a simple pine coffin. Mm-hmm. And, but his key message was really about organizing. And he said this multiple times throughout the conference, that if we want to see change, we need to form a community, that we have strength in numbers, that we have a choice, and that we all need to take action together. So that was, to me, more of an action-oriented and less of, you know, more of an ideological type of conversation. Although, you know, maybe overall it was like lacking a bit of information that people needed. But I think that Karen Smith from the Funeral Consumers Alliance kind of helped bridge that gap by saying there's so much material that we have. Our job is essentially to fight for your rights as a consumer to have the funeral that you want for your family to deal with, and to deal with your bodies, essentially. And that, I think, was uplifting to people because, you know, a lot of the folks there, some of them work in death care, a lot of them don't. Some of them were there out of pure interest. And I think that this particular panel was sort of a key introduction for people who want to start thinking about their choices and their family's choices and really where to begin.
And, you know, a lot of the conversations I had with attendees at the death salon, people often talked about how isolating the experience of death acceptance and death awareness can be, right? They want to do something. They don't know what.
Yeah, I wonder, were there a lot of people, you said there were people there that were just curious. I wonder how many people, or if you met many people who were there just to have a community to talk to about this stuff without feeling like a weird, like a weirdo, or feeling like a pariah even at worst.
Yeah, definitely. I think that quite a few of the people we met felt kind of more comfortable or at home because they, you know, just like I would say we are kind of, you know, the oddball, so to speak, of their friends and family because they're quote unquote obsessed with death. And I think that a lot of people went there to be around a community of peers and of like-minded people and maybe who are also goths, but that's like another story.
The funny thing is the research that I do is on a community that is the exact opposite of death, the death positive community. I research transhumanism, and I had spent time at a conference for transhumanists, and I heard the exact same thing where they were saying, you know, we want to live forever, and that makes us social pariahs and people just don't understand us and we need to band together as a community. And, you know, the people around you are the people who really understand you. And then a week later, I went to Death Salon and heard the exact same thing, but with death acceptance, right?
Well, interesting. I mean, both really are talking about death. It may be from different, totally different vantage points and opinions of death, but both are starting a conversation that people are not that comfortable having, which is that mortality is a thing that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a historian, John Gray, who writes about the transhumanist movement. He says that the ironic thing about trying to avoid death is that you end up spending all of your time thinking about death.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's great. That's so true.
Yeah. And then sort of continuing the community perspective on reclaiming death care. This year, for the first time, I believe, there was the Death Positive Award that was awarded, in this case, to Lisa Carlson.
That's right.
So that was a big deal, and that was really wonderful. And
we were very upset that we weren't nominated. But
oh my God. but just to quickly, so that people understand a bit more, the Death Positive Award honor someone whose work inspired the leaders of the death positive movement and paved the way for the work being done today. And so Lisa Carlson is a funeral consumer activist, a tireless lobbyist, and also the author of 4 books on death care, probably the better one, and probably the one that she's most known for is Caring for the Dead, Your Final Act of Love.
She was very interesting. She told us the story of how she started, and when her husband died decades ago, her first husband, she decided that she wanted to take on as much of the process as she could, but she found all of these sort of stumbling blocks along the way. Obviously, the first thing that the hospital wanted to do was call the funeral director, and the funeral director wanted to embalm, and then they wanted to be the ones to care, you know, to take the dead to the cemetery. And Lisa Carlson thought that there has to be a better way. And so she took on the care of, she took on caring for her husband's body on her own.
As much as she could.
As much as she could.
She got like a funeral director involved and sort of negotiated, you know, what she could do And, you know, that's kind of like the OG of, you know, of caring for your own dead. And, and so it was really interesting hearing it from her. And she was, honestly, it felt like looking at like, you know, Caitlin in 60 or, well, I don't know how many years, but it was just so interesting to see them in conversation because, you know, I was hearing Lisa say things that I've definitely heard Caitlin say many times before, and like conversations that I've had with Caitlin sort of, you know, outside of what I've heard her say in the conference. And it was just, you know, everyone was just kind of nodding their head because it just resonated with a lot of people. And what I think was really interesting about her story and was sort of the catalyst for her, you know, writing the books that she did and becoming a funeral consumer activist was that after she did that for her husband, people from the community or people that she didn't even know that heard of her story called her and asked her how they could do the same thing for their loved ones. I feel like her presentation definitely resonated with a lot of people, and it was a very sort of encouraging thing to see, you know, people fighting the good fight for so long and still being as passionate and as influential.
Yeah, I think it really helped people feel a little less isolated. And yeah, you know, a lot of people are going to be going, a lot of people are there alone or there with a friend, and after the conference is over, they're going home to Missouri or, you know, California or wherever they're going home, and might feel at a loss in terms of what it is that they should do next. And I think that a lot of the talks during Death Salon tried to answer that or tried to provide some additional resources for people to start spreading the message of death positivity and death acceptance.
Yeah. And what did you guys feel coming out of the Death Salon? Did you have a similar feeling of inspiration, and have you cooked up any plans of how to bring some of this into the incredible work that you're already doing?
I mean, in terms of Talk Death, yes. I mean, it really motivated us to, it really motivated us to explore topics that we haven't explored before. And to reach out to people who we didn't know before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what was really interesting for us was, you know, not to again bring up the fact that people like recognized us and knew who we were, but just that in itself made us realize that, you know, we're making some type of a ripple and that people are interested in learning more about these subjects. And even though there's quite a few different people and sites talking about, you know, death positivity super general or having resources around home funerals and green burials, that there's still a need for more, and that there's still a community around it and it's growing. And so I think what we came out of it, or definitely what I came out of it at least, was that this type of work is important and it's needed. And from there, you know, we made a lot of really great connections in terms of people that, you know, we met over the internet. And I think a lot of people had that where, you know, we were talking to even some of the vendors who just got to meet people that they've been chatting with, like through Instagram, and getting to meet people in person and, you know, kind of put a face to that is really important. And it solidifies the community a lot. So I think we definitely got a sense of community out of it, for sure.
Yeah. And even though the death positive community is not the community that I study in my work, I was still taking notes the entire time. And I still found it to be very beneficial, you know, just in terms of a comparative, like in terms of comparing different groups, let's say.
Right. And do you guys feel that, was there any particular theme that you felt excited about looking forward to the, I mean, I can relate of having a year of content ahead of you?
Definitely.
Tell me about some of the other themes that came up at Death Salon.
Yeah. So still kind of based around this conversation around community, there was definitely an element of humanity that was brought up in dying and in death care. And a talk in particular that I definitely wanted to bring up was Peter Steffen, who did an interview with Sarah Chavez. And it was about burying the unwanted dead, and in particular, the Boston bomber in this case. So this is the funeral director who's the president of Graham Platinum and Mahoney Funeral Parlors in Massachusetts. He spoke about his experience essentially burying the Boston bomber, which is a really big deal. Yeah. So, you know, I think he was introduced by Sarah as being, or no, actually he was introduced by Caitlin. She saw him at an event or at a sort of a conversation, and she like immediately was able to pick him out of the room as being a funeral director. And I think she was actually giving a talk, and then he raised his hand, and, you know, her first thought was, oh gosh, is, you know, is he gonna try to, you know, her first thought was, oh, is he gonna try to, you know, bring me down or make some type of a controversial statement? And he was the opposite. And, you know, he was a super charming man. And I don't know, I think his main focus was, you know, a human is a human, a body is a body. There's a lot of politics around it. There was a lot of people in the community that, you know, they were like throwing food at him afterwards, you know, after he did that. And he definitely distanced himself from his community by doing that. But something that I actually thought was really interesting, someone asked a question about this. His business actually boomed by 50% after doing that burial, which is super interesting because even though his community was super upset with him, his business still boomed. But I assume that that's just based off of, you know, getting the type of press that he did.
Maybe no publicity really is bad publicity. I find that really, really interesting. I mean, just this whole concept of, does everybody deserve a good burial? Does every person deserve funerary rites? Is death so sacred that nothing we've done in life even precludes us from deserving respect in death?
Exactly. And I mean, there's even this really practical issue of, what do you do when no one claims a body, right? And this is something that happens all the time, where, you know, there's no next of kin, or the government can't find anybody, or they're, you know, estranged from their family and their family doesn't want to have to deal with it and deal with the expenses around it and them. And this is something that you see often. And I actually work as a funeral director's assistant as well. And I even started working with them because I was assisting at unclaimed burials, where this funeral home in particular actually sort of has a mission to be a really key provider in helping with unclaimed bodies. And essentially the government gives you very little money that doesn't even really cover the cost. Like a lot of the cost has to even come out of, you know, the business's own pockets, interestingly enough, to be able to just, you know, take that body, maybe embalm it, maybe not, generally not, transfer it and have enough people, essentially pallbearers, to be able to, you know, walk that casket from the coach to the graveside. And it's really interesting. And, you know, being involved in this, it's always, it's hard to kind of put your finger on it, but it's like partly sad that you're the only ones kind of there for this person, but then it feels like you're really doing them a service by, you know, saying a few words. We always put a flower on their casket as we lower it. You know, there's people there to sort of give them a final, you know, dignified send off. And this is a real problem. And so this is where you see the humanity and the community come out of dying and death care. And to be honest, it's not, you know, funeral home practitioner. It's not home funeral practitioners. It's not, you know, these death activists that are doing this work. It's actually the funeral industry and it's funeral professionals that are taking this on. And I think that, you know, having this conversation with Peter and people understanding that funeral directors have to do this type of work, that, you know, they could be great humans too.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, the modern cemetery was meant to take care of, I mean, it was meant to take care of a few problems, but one of them had to do with dead bodies, right? When people were buried in churchyards, you had all of these jurisdictional dilemmas. You know, can a Protestant be buried in a Catholic cemetery? Can a Catholic be buried in a Protestant cemetery? What if someone, what if a criminal wants to be buried in a churchyard? You know, there's all these sorts of issues and political issues that were going on with churchyard burials, and cemeteries were supposed to solve a lot of these issues. They were supposed to be these public grounds that were accessible to everyone. But I think that, you know, the case of the Boston bomber and other infamous people throughout modern history, I think it shows us that a lot of these dilemmas still exist.
And is also still very political,
yeah,
right? Just going back to the theme of politics, for sure.
Yeah, way to bring it full circle. Do you guys want to give me a couple of quick hits of any other themes or talks that we should know about before we wrap up?
I think there's one more that was really important, and definitely connects to these kind of questions about politics and dying. And that was Michael Dowling's talk. It was titled "Holding the Human Condition: Art and Grief Around HIV/AIDS Epidemic and Beyond." It was a powerful talk that he gave. It was almost like watching a piece of performative art.
Yeah.
Really. And so for the past, 20 some odd years now, he's been doing this performative art piece called The Medicine Wheel. And every year he asks people to contribute to the process of healing from the HIV and AIDS epidemic in different ways. A lot of the ways are very embodied. And so for 1 year, he created these pawns in his studio space, and he asked people to go to the river, fill up buckets of water, and carry them back to the art space and then dump them into the man-made ponds. And there was another year where he asked people to carry these heavy stones into the art space and leave them on the ground. And
you're like just even moving them around the room or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the idea that, I mean, there are a few ideas around that, but I think a lot of it really had to do with this kind of meditative form of healing. And I heard so many people crying during his talk. It was powerful.
It was definitely the most powerful talk, I would say, of the conference for sure.
Wow.
And there was no slides. Like, it was just him up there, like no script written in front of him. And he just spoke so well. And it was just dead silence and crying that you heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a reminder too that HIV and AIDS is a problem that people are still dealing with, and that, you know, there are still people alive who lost entire communities of people, lost entire families to the HIV and AIDS epidemic.
He said something like one in every six gay men died of HIV, like in Massachusetts even, or something like
wow.
that. It was some type of, I don't have the exact statistic, but it was something, you know, really intense like that.
Yeah. Again, like looking at how death is political and how just being a part of a different community, being a minority, being LGBTQ, your experience of death probably is completely different from somebody else's in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those of us who talk about, you know, how we don't speak about death very much, that might be a form of privilege, right? Because a lot of people are forced to talk about death a lot. And any gay man in his 50s, you know, has talked about death a lot in his time.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of opportunity here to be reflexive and to listen and to learn. And I think that was a really positive takeaway from the death salon at Mount Auburn this year.
And speaking of, you know, of power and of movement and of action, something that I'm not sure if you're aware, but the way that they actually closed off the death salon this year was by not announcing where death salon is going to be next year, because they want to encourage leaders in all cities to actually come together and create their own versions of death salon, you know, everywhere. And so to my understanding, there's not going to be a death salon next year. There are going to be death salons where, you know, I think Sarah brought up how we are all, you know, kind of like foot soldiers is essentially how she put it, and how, you know, they're going to support a lot of us in creating events that are more accessible, because that's definitely something that came up for a lot of people, just in, you know, the cost of attending, but, you know, the privilege of being able to have a flight or drive there and book a place to stay.
And preaching to the choir, right? It's a conversation that's happening amongst people who are already aware of the conversation.
Exactly. So it's like, how are we actually, I think, you know, the question, you know, how are we really going to accomplish what we set out to do? This is not just about speaking to a community of our peers. It's about making a difference, you know, as large as we can. And so I'm really curious as to, you know, how their call to action is going to go. But, you know, I see it as being smaller events, inexpensive events, maybe some of them that are going to be more focused around hands-on work, like, you know, writing out your will and understanding end-of-life planning and, you know, maybe how to workshops on how to prepare a body. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see all the different people that were in that room and that are in this community right now actually come together and put something together themselves for their communities, because that's where I think, you know, going back to this political issue and you know, giving minorities and people that are underprivileged, you know, more of an upper hand is by giving them these sort of more hands-on workshops and by, you know, of course, educating, you know, the public within your cities about all of these issues as well.
Wow, that's very powerful. That's pretty cool. So they're franchising.
Yeah, pretty much.
Amazing. Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It will be a lot more accessible, and I bet people will be inspired to do that. So I'd love to end by asking people if they have one wish, just to put you on the spot for a sec, because I didn't warn you. If you have one wish for your own death, each of you, what would that be? Doesn't have to be your number one wish ever, but, you know, just something you wish for yourself in death.
No suffering and at the end of a long life.
Sounds pretty good.
It's a little selfish, you know, but it's, you know, it's...
You actually cover a lot of bases with that answer. That might be our best answer yet.
I've learned from genies granting wishes, you know, you need to be broad and specific at the same time.
Nice.
I think I would just want something simple, and I would want my family, whatever, you know, that looks like when I die, hopefully not prematurely, quote unquote, to be involved in some way and to provide them with an experience that they may not have had otherwise. And not that like they have to wash my body if they don't want to, or dress me if they don't want to, but do something that will hopefully, you know, help them in their grief. Hopefully they are grieving me. And just to give them sort of an opportunity that they wouldn't have otherwise, and open them up to a different experience that will hopefully help them not fear their own death as much.
Cool, to kind of make the connection to your body and death.
Yeah, totally.
Beautiful. Well, thank you both so, so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org.